Welcome back, dear students. Are you in for a treat? Because you are going to see my attempt at getting our arms around the mutual fund industry. It's not an easy thing to do. On the website, you will see a document entitled Mutual Fund Scramble Sheet. I suggest you print it out, or at least have it on the screen to bounce back and forth, because this scramble sheet is my attempt to try to show the breadth and width of the mutual fund offerings and the relationships, the inner relationships between different types of mutual funds, because it's gotten very complicated. And we're going to go from the riskiest mutual funds to the least riskiest mutual funds. Okay, so the very riskiest to the least riskiest. And in the face-to-face class, of course, I put these on the board and from one side of the board all the way to the other side of the board. You can't do that in an online class, so I created this mutual fund scramble sheet. And again, my apologies for my artistic abilities or lack thereof. Slide 39, we have the most aggressive mutual funds. And sure enough, they're called aggressive growth mutual funds. Highly speculative mutual funds that seek large profits from capital gains. Folks, day is rolling the dice. They are shooting for the moon, hitting the home run pitch, Hail Mary pass, whatever analogy you want to use. They're trying to create eye-popping returns. And as it says at the bottom, some fund companies have a category or two more speculative than aggressive growth. They're sometimes called ultra funds or momentum funds. One such example is Janus 20. Janus is the name of the mutual fund family. We'll discuss families in the next presentation. And 20 is the name of the mutual fund. Why 20? Do you remember back when we first discussed mutual funds? What is the minimum number of investments a mutual fund must have according to the Investment Company Act of 1940? Right, 20. You have to have at least 20 because you can put no more than 5% into any one investment. So this mutual fund trumpets the fact that they are going to be a concentrated mutual fund. Wait a minute. Why do we buy mutual funds? You remember the two major reasons? Right. Professional money management and diversification. So here's a mutual fund that is concentrating. What do you think of this strategy? Huh? What do you think of aggressive growth? What do you think of turnovers of 200% or more? They don't hold a stock more than, say, 6 months, the average. I'm not a big fan. And the analogy I like to use, I don't know if it's good analogy, is food. Aggressive growth funds are like jalapeno peppers, folks, or cayenne pepper, or habaneros. You don't go to a buffet and load up your plate with habanero peppers, do you? Well, maybe a couple of you do, but no, it's a spice. You put a little bit on there to spice things up. So please don't put your whole 401k contribution into aggressive growth funds. 5, 10, maybe 20%, folks. You with me? And this is what people do. They will be overly aggressive, in my humble opinion, because they are in it for the long term, and they're going to hold this thing for the long time, and they're going to get rich until the first bear market, until the thing loses 30, 40, 50, 60%, and then they run for the hills just in time for the market to turn around and the thing go up 80%. Do you think this doesn't happen? It happens. That's why it happens. That's how it happens, because people run out of the market when it falls, and they jump back in after it's come back. Yeah. So my advice is to if you're going to, and I don't even, personally, I don't use these. I don't recommend them to my family, friends, clients. But if you're going to use these, stick to no more than 5, 10, maybe 20%. The next category are growth funds. And growth funds are mutual funds whose primary goals are capital gains and long-term growth. They typically invest in high-growth companies. So, yeah, these are spicy, but not as spicy as the aggressive growth funds. But still, some of them are extremely aggressive, and you can lose a lot of money. You can make a lot of money, but you can lose a lot of money. Now, the next category are called capital appreciation funds. Huh? These are mutual funds that seek long-term growth of capital. Okay, Piano. How does that differ from a growth fund? Huh? Sounds like the same thing. Well, often they are categorized with growth funds. And if you look at the scramble sheet, you see that I've written capital appreciation funds around aggressive growth and growth to try to show you that they are associated with them, but they're not the same. Most growth funds have a provision that states that they will invest primarily in growth stocks, usually staying between 80% and 100% invested in the market. Now, what are growth stocks? We haven't covered stocks yet, but you'll learn more about them when we get to Chapter 5. But it's suffice to say that they're the darlings of the industry. They're the companies that are growing the quickest. But capital appreciation funds can often invest in anything they like and anywhere they like. They don't have to invest in growth stocks. They could invest in companies that are out of favor with the market for whatever reason. We call those value stocks sometimes. Sometimes they're called turnarounds. They could invest in cyclical or defensive companies. And what are those? Relax. We'll learn about those when we get to Chapter 5. So they don't have to invest in growth stocks. In general, they tend to be as risky as growth and aggressive growth stocks funds, but not always. So you see what we're up against? You see that you have to be very, very careful, and you have to read the materials and ask a lot of questions. What kind of a capital appreciation fund is this? I tend to use the analogy, I don't know if it's a good analogy, but I say that capital appreciation funds paint with a broad brush. Does that make any sense, you art fans? Whereas a growth fund or an aggressive growth fund will stick with the growth stocks, the hard-charging companies, a capital appreciation fund might decide, oh, no, we think that it's time to be in this area of the market, or we think it's just time to be in this area of the market. They can invest in a wide range of companies. And one well-known capital appreciation fund is the Fidelity Magellan Fund. This Magellan Fund was run by a gentleman by the name of Peter Lynch, and we'll come back to him. He's a very interesting character, one of the best mutual fund managers in history. And it suited him perfectly because he had that painting with a broad brush type of attitude. He looked at all different types of companies. And it was often said of him that he never met a company he didn't like. And he was just a wonderful stock picker. And because he ran a fund that allowed him the flexibility to invest in pretty much any company he found that he liked, it worked very, very well. Let's continue. The next group are called growth and income funds. And growth and income funds I like to think of as the pasta, or the main dish, the meat and potatoes. This is what you want, you know, the biggest portion on your plate to be. Mutual funds that seek both long-term growth and current income, with primary emphasis usually on capital gains. So you understand, remember when we said in the first chapter about stocks that we buy stocks because our rewards are our dividends and capital gains. So growth and income is looking for both capital gains. Yes, we want them, but we also want dividends. We want income from our stocks. And sometimes, depending on the mutual fund, they might own some bonds to augment the income, but not usually. Usually they're going to be mostly all invested in stocks. Now, these growth and income funds are sometimes they're sometimes referred to as blend funds, a blend of growth and value. So you have to be, Morningstar likes to call them blend funds. We'll see Morningstar later on. They're a company that rates mutual funds, that analyzes mutual funds. They also get to be lumped in with value funds. And value funds, again, you have to look at each individual mutual fund carefully, because these people, we're going to see that these terms get bandied about and people use them differently than what we normally think of value. These are mutual funds that seek stocks that are undervalued in the market by investing in shares that have low PE multiples and high dividend. What are you talking about, Pagano? I know, this is one of the problems of doing mutual funds first. We don't understand what PE is. We kind of know what dividends are. But what they're doing is they're looking for companies that are out of favor with investors. So you'll notice on the scramble sheet that I have growth and income, and then around it again, I'm making motions with my hands, but you can't see those. We have the words value, and we have the word blend, because some folks lump growth and income funds and value funds and blend funds all together. But just know that we're looking for a mixture of capital gains and dividend, growth and income. Slide number 42. Now, equity income funds. What a silly name. Well, equity means stock, and income from stocks is dividend. So why don't they just call them stock dividend funds? No, they call them equity income funds, and you're supposed to understand that that means stock dividends. Yeah. These are mutual funds that emphasize current income and capital preservation by investing primarily in high-yielding income-producing common stocks. So you understand, these mutual funds are not looking for growth, folks. We're not trying to shoot the lights out and make everybody's eyes pop open and hit the home run. No, we're going with big companies that are paying dividends and have been around for how many years have railroads been around? 170 years. Food companies, utilities, real estate investment trusts. They also invest in bonds to generate income when the investment advisor believes that stock prices have risen to levels that threaten preservation of capital. So in our food analogy, what are equity income funds? Oatmeal. Is oatmeal exciting? And does it really make your mouth water and just you can't? But is it good for you? Sure. Yes, oatmeal is very good for you. Look what it does for horses. But, you know, it's not very exciting. Well, equity income funds are kind of boring. In the investing world, folks, boring is often very, very good. And in the late 1990s, these things almost became extinct. Not really, but just people just didn't even want to. Ugh, equity income. Ugh, how boring. How ridiculous. You want growth. Well, you know what? They lagged the market badly in the late 1990s because they didn't invest in the internet companies and the telecom companies and the computer companies. But during the 2000 to 2002 bear market, they shined, because all of a sudden investors had a renewed appreciation for Kellogg's and General Mills and San Diego Gas and Electric. Yes, so these things got what goes around comes around. They had their time in the sun during the bear market. Some of them went up when everybody else was going down. How did they do in 2008? Oh, yeah, not so good. Right, I remember everybody got clobbered. So, but they held up generally better in 2008 than their other cousins. So you see those on this So taking now a good look now at this mutual fund scramble sheet, you see we've got from the riskiest stock funds down to the least risky. Good. Because now we're going to turn the channel, right? We're going to now take a look at slide 43, and we're going to see that there are more classifications. There are more groups or columns, if you will, more groups of stock mutual funds. And the first group classifies them by how large the companies are. And the names are large cap, mid cap, small cap. What are they talking about? Cap? Are they talking about baseball cap? No. It stands for capitalization, and we'll discuss it in detail in chapter 5, and we'll actually do some calculations. But all you have to know is that the large cap are the papa bears, the mid cap are the mama bears, and the small cap are the baby bears. Now, which do you think is the riskiest? Well, sure, small companies are the riskiest. Remember Chapter 1? We didn't even want to use that data. They are risky, but they tend to return. Yeah, exactly. More risk, more return. Not guaranteed. The large companies have the resources and have the markets. Their roots are deep in the economy. So they can weather the storms much better than small companies, and of course mid-cap companies are somewhere in between. The next category refers to where the company is based, its domesticity. Where is the company based? And we've already talked about this. Remember, domestic is based in the United States. International is based outside the United States, sometimes called foreign, so remember that distinction. And of course, global is in between. Now, which one do you think here is the riskiest? Well, you might be tempted to say international, and you're probably still right, but it's nowhere near a clear distinction as it was 50 years ago, or even 20 years ago. It used to be that domestic funds were far less risky, international were the riskiest, and global were somewhere in between. But that's not true anymore. The world is global. There are some companies in the United States, but actually many. Many of the companies we think is brand name, household names, make more of their money outside the United States than they do inside the United States. There are companies based outside the United States that make most of their money based in the United States. So it's all mixed up. It's all mixed up. So that the risk being outside the United States and this is not true anymore. So if you take a look now at the mutual fund scramble sheet, you'll see that I have this. Domestic, large cap, growth and income fund, right? Or it's a global, small cap, aggressive growth fund. So you pick one from column A, one from column B, and one from column C. So now do you understand how there could be 9,000, 10,000 mutual funds? Because the market has balkanized. It's a fancy term for broken up. It's been splintered. And when one company has a global, small cap, aggressive growth fund, then of course all the competitors have to have them. So you see what's happened? Yeah, right. That's why it's so crazy. That's why there's over 9,000, 10,000 of these things. Then we now break them up into regions. You can buy a Japanese fund, a Canadian fund, a Latin American fund, a Far East fund, emerging markets, India, Mexico, Brazil, Russia, China, Philippines, Turkey. Yeah, amazing. And what about sector funds? Sector funds invest in a certain sector of the economy. Energy, energy resources, energy drilling, the energy equipment companies. Technology is broken up into several different sectors. Healthcare, chemicals, wireless. Leisure and entertainment and fast food. There are all these sector funds that focus in on a single sector. Now, wait a minute. Regional, emerging, market sector. What's going on here? Why do we buy a mutual fund in the first place? We buy a mutual fund for professional money management and diversification. What are these funds doing? Right, they're concentrating. Give me a global fund. any day of the year. Not that I don't think India or Mexico or Brazil are going to do well. They're all three are actually doing very well. Russia, Philippines is it's doing okay. China, obviously. Turkey, huh? Yeah, most people don't realize, but Turkey's been on a tear. Turkey's been doing really well economically lately. But no, I want broad diversification. That's why I bought the mutual fund. So that's my humble opinion. You may decide, oh, I know a little bit about Latin America, and what I see, it looks pretty good. I'm going to put some of my, don't put all of your money, but put some of your money there. Now, if anybody tries to sell you a market timing fund, I can't believe they would have the audacity to even admit to market timing. There's a saying that we'll come back to, don't try to time the market. It can only be done by liars. So, yeah, if someone just stay away. Stay away from any kind of market timing fund. So do you see what's going on here? Wow, yeah, right. It's a mess, and you have to sort of sort these things through. Now, the next group are bond funds. Okay, so we're going from the stock funds being the riskiest, and now we're going to bond funds. Fixed income funds, slide number 44. These are mutual funds that invest in various kinds and grades of bonds, with income as the primary objective normally. So we're going to go from the highest risk to the lowest risk. And the first group, the first category, the highest risk bond funds, are called high yield bond funds, or sometimes called high income bond funds. What's the common term for them? Junk bond. Wait a minute, that doesn't sound good, does it? Yeah, junk bonds can be very dangerous, folks. That's why we call them junk. Some people will refer to them as non-investment grade bond funds or distressed bond funds. And what's going on here is that the companies that are issuing the bonds, sometimes the municipalities, are in danger of default. So, high risk, exactly, the potential for high reward if the companies pull through, if the municipalities pull through, is there. But you have to realize it's not normally why you buy a bond fund. You don't normally buy. In fact, these things start to look like stock funds. They tend to do well when the economy does well and stock funds do well, and they tend to do poorly when the economy falters, which is the exact opposite of most bonds. Bonds tend to go the other way. The next group are corporate bond funds, and we'll discuss that later. Corporate bond funds, and then convertible bonds. Remember the hybrids? Ignore these. But most corporate bond funds are, you know, very staid and stodgy companies that have been around forever and will pay their debts on time. But so they're fairly conservative, and they pay decently, not spectacular, but decently. The next group are the muni bonds, municipal and insured municipal bond funds. Now, we talked a little bit about municipal bonds. They're issued by state and local governments, school districts and cities and bridge authorities, very popular with high net worth individuals because the income is free from federal taxes. And if you buy your bonds, your bond funds from your state, you're also not going to pay state taxes as well. But it turns out, as we'll see later on when we get to bonds, these are mostly popular with very high net worth, which is a fancy way of saying rich bums. They're the ones that want these things. Slide number 45, the least riskiest bond funds. And who do you think issue the least? Of course, the Treasury. Well, now, wait a minute. Notice before we have government bonds, we have U.S.-backed bonds. What? Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae. Is that a candy company? Well, we'll discuss these in detail when we get the bonds, but these bonds are issued not by the federal government, folks, but by agencies of the federal government or corporations that were spun off or sponsored by the federal government. And this is what, they're not the only ones, folks. They're just one, yet another player in the mix. They weren't the only ones who made very bad loans to homeowners. But the mortgage-backed bond funds invest in bonds that are based on people's mortgages. And this system worked great for decades until the whole system got out of whack. And some people blame Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They just blame them. No, they were just two of the players. There are dozens of others, and they certainly didn't have the majority of the, but they certainly had a big group of them. So, how do these things work? Well, the federal government had an implicit guarantee that if Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac were to go under, don't worry, we'll back them up. They never explicitly said that. In fact, they would explicitly say, no, 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 they're private corporations. But investors believed that if anything went wrong, the government would step in. And sure enough, in 2008, when the organic matter hit the Ventolin device, you are now proud owner of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, right? The government stepped in. Government bond funds are bond funds that invest in treasury bonds, government bonds. Because they're treasury bonds based on the U.S. Treasury, they're free from state and local taxes. You still have to pay federal income taxes. And they are by far the least riskiest. And the federal government will pay it. Well, sure it will, won't it? Yes, it will. Don't let S&P scare you. The federal government will pay its debts. Now, the next group. So what you have right now, if you look at the scramble sheet, are the most riskiest, the junk bonds, down to the least riskiest, the government bonds. And then, just as we did with stocks, we're going to overlay on top of that two other categories. And in this category is the maturity date. When do these bonds mature? Are they long-term, intermediate-term, or short-term bonds? Now, L, large, long-term, short, small cap, intermediate sounds like mid. You might be tempted to say the long-term bond funds are the least riskiest and the short-term bond funds are the most. No, it's exactly the opposite. So it has nothing to do with the category large cap, small cap, mid cap that we've looked at stocks. But think about it. It makes sense when you think about it. If you're going to lend money to people, doesn't it make sense that there's more risk if you lend it for the long term than if you lend it for the short? Exactly. So short-term bond funds, depending on how short they are, sometimes you'll see it say ultra short, they start to look like short-term investments. They start to look like money markets and CDs and the like. So long-term bond funds are the most riskiest, short-term least riskiest, and obviously intermediate is intermediate. And then, of course, global, domestic, and international. So again, we have the same situation where you pick one from column A and one from column B and one from column C. Slide 46, balance funds. Mutual funds whose objective is to generate a balanced return of both income and long-term gap of capital gains, they invest in both stocks and bonds. Wait a minute. Shouldn't this be in between? Shouldn't they be in between stocks and bonds in terms of risk? You told me, Payano, that we're going from the riskiest to the least riskiest. No. It's counterintuitive, but when you mix bonds and stocks together, you get a portfolio that actually is less risky. But go back and remember that we don't really have a very good measurement of risk. So how are we after we go through stocks, after we go through bonds, we will discuss how a mixture of both actually turns out to be less risky. And what the bond manager will do is normally keep around 60-40 or 50-50. 60% stocks, 40% bonds. But the allocation can change as the investment environment changes. Now, here's a balance fund that's been around forever, American Balance Fund. The prospectus of the American Balance Fund states that the fund is managed as the complete U.S. investment program of a prudent investor. They can never be more than 75% stocks, 25% bonds when they think stocks are screaming good deals, nor can they be less than 50% stocks, 50% bonds when they think bonds are a good deal. So you see, they keep a balance. And balance funds are very popular. Why? Think of what we just said. You don't have to worry how much stocks, how much bonds. The bond manager, the mutual fund manager does that for you. They work together looking for both stock good investments, bond good investments. And if all goes well, which there's no guarantees, you should get a less, let's use the word volatile, right? Risk, that's how we measure risk, less volatile portfolio. And for that reason, balance funds are very popular in retirement plans. Mm-hmm. Slide number 47, asset allocation. Wait a minute. Slide 47, mutual funds that spread investors' money across stocks, bonds, and money market securities. Well, that sounds very similar to balance funds. Well, not quite. The investment advisor in an asset allocation fund usually more diligently tries to fine-tune the allocation as market conditions change. Whereas a balance fund usually stays around 60% stocks, 40% bonds, an asset allocation fund might try to move money into cash when they thought the market might fall. Yikes, you see? Does that sound like market timing to you? You gotta be careful. Some of these asset allocation funds are closet market timing funds. And for all their hype, the returns of many asset allocation funds are very close to balance funds, but some trail balance funds considerably because they timed the market badly. So all things being equal, and of course they never are, if you gave me the option of a balance fund or an asset allocation fund, I would zoom over to the balance fund. But you gotta do more research than just the name. You understand? You gotta just more research than the name. And some asset allocation funds might be managed like a balance fund, and some balance fund might be managed like an asset allocation fund. So, be careful. Read the prospectus. Read the literature. Do your analysis. And ask a lot of questions. Slide number 48. The least riskiest of all mutual funds are money market mutual funds. Well, this is review. We discuss these when we discuss short-term investments. Mutual funds that invest in short-term money market instruments. They're the same as money market accounts at banks and credit unions, with the big exception that they are not guaranteed. But, yeah, they really are. If someone's going to step in and make these things whole. There are general purpose that invest in treasury bills, commercial papers, some that are government securities, only treasury bills, some that are tax exempt with very short-term municipal securities. You see, when bonds get to be short-term, they're going to mature soon, they look like a treasury bill or a corporate paper. They are essentially as safe as guaranteed money market accounts at the bank since they invest in exactly the same securities, but they are not guaranteed. Did we mention? I think we mentioned that. And we talked about breaking the buck. When a mutual fund, money market mutual fund, actually loses the money, it drops from a dollar to 99 cents. And the whole world sits up and takes notice. And the company does its best to take its own money and put it into the mutual fund so that they won't drop in value, and the regulators say no problem, and the other companies say you got it. Well, you need some more money. We'll give you some to prop you up. Yeah, slide number 49. Now, so we've gone from the most riskiest to least riskiest, and now we're now looking at other types of mutual funds. We're off the most riskiest to least riskiest. Okay, so we're looking at different groups, and these are mutual funds of mutual. Well, you knew it had to happen, right? Exactly. Well, these are actually very, very popular, and there's a reason why. They're often called lifestyle funds, target date funds. When you look at the TSP, the Thrift Savings Plan assignment, you're going to see that I ask you some questions about those because they have some, they call them the L funds. You choose a fund that matches your time horizon, college 2020 for your kid and in a few years. Retirement in 2035 or 2050. The company will then populate the mutual fund with other mutual funds, normally in their own portfolio of mutual funds, the company, to match the time horizon. Usually, as it says, often from the same company's mutual fund choices. As the time horizon shortens, the mutual fund will change the mix of mutual funds and move from the most riskiest and the riskier down to the least riskier. And some are target risk funds. You choose your risk tolerance, they choose your funds. And I have a little snide remark at the bottom that says, a mutual fund of mutual funds? Sure, I don't mean mine being charged twice. Well, they do charge you, but it's very, very little just to manage the mutual fund of mutual funds, because the mutual funds in the mutual fund are charging you already. Are you confused yet? Why are these popular? Well, there's a very good reason. In retirement accounts, especially specifically 401ks and 403bs, in retirement plans at employers, if you're the employer and you offer your employees these lifestyle funds, these target date funds, then you can literally automatically enroll your employee in the 401k. And providing you choose the lifestyle fund that corresponds to their birth date, then the employee can't sue you. Isn't that wonderful? So you have to opt out. It was before the Congress allowed this that employers were very reticent to automatically enroll their employees in the 401k plans because they were afraid of being sued. And if they did enroll them, they enrolled them in the money market fund because that one can't lose money. But wait a minute. That's not a very prudent choice if somebody's not going to retire for 40 years. So the companies were kind of worried they could be sued for making bad investment decisions on behalf of their employees, as just like a broker could be sued. If a broker puts somebody who's 22 years old into a money market and it's for a Roth IRA, well, that's a really bad investment choice. Unless the person just screamed up and down and hollered and said, I do not want to lose a dime, well, then you're kind of stuck. But they're going to be at it for 30, 40 years, maybe longer, you millennials. That's a very bad choice. So now, as long as you, the employer, have these target date funds, cool. You're protected. You see why they're popular? Yes, they are. Slide number 50. Specialty funds. Folks, stay away from these things. The silliness does not end here. Specialty funds. Hedge funds. These are not mutual funds. They should not even be discussed in Chapter 4, although the book discusses them, and I put them in here, because they're often lumped in with mutual funds. But they have virtually no regulatory oversight. They are not bound by the Investment Company Act of 1940. Every time the SEC wants to rein in these things, the industry, which has some very powerful lobbyists and some very powerful friends in Congress, fights back and says, no, leave us alone. Well, traditionally, they were only open to sophisticated investors, and that's a legal term. That means you have over $1 million in liquid assets, or you're making $200,000 a year, or I forget the other criteria. But now, they're available to people with as little as $5,000 or $10,000. So, in other words, these things were for people who could afford to lose a lot of money, because you often do. The fees are outrageous. 1-2%, plus they take 20% of the profits. Outrageous! But, hey, my advice, stay away from hedge funds, folks. Just stay away. Bear funds? Well, what is a bear market? That's when the market falls. These funds try to make money when the market falls. That's not an easy thing to do unless the market's falling, but the market usually rises 3 years for every 1 year it goes down, but that's not a guarantee that it's going to be 3 years up and 1 year down. It just doesn't work that way. I suggest you stay away from bear funds. How about precious metals and hard asset funds, and funds that invest in gold or silver? Unless you believe that the world is going to fall apart, in which case you really need to get yourself out of the Northern Hemisphere, down to Tierra del Fuego or Tasmania, and learn to raise goats and grow your own food. Well, here's actually not a bad choice. Real Estate Investment Trust, if you want to invest in real estate, but you don't want to be a landlord, you can invest in real estate investment trust funds. And these mutual funds buy they're not really companies. They're called trusts. But they look like a company to all of us. These are the people who own the shopping centers and the malls and the apartment complexes and office buildings and the like. The problem is there's just not that many real estate investment trusts, and some are very good and some are awful, so you don't really get good diversification, although some people like them. Now, these exotic funds, these boutique funds, folks, stay away. It is insane, the number and the ridiculousness of some of these funds. What do you think the stock car stocks fund invests in? Come on, take a guess. Yeah, NASCAR, but not the cars themselves. They invest in the logos, you know, the sponsors of NASCAR. Because I know it's hard to believe, but the biggest spectator sport in the United States is NASCAR. Figure that one out. So if Nextel is the official cell phone of NASCAR, which it is, or used to be, I don't know if it still is, then all these NASCAR fans, they have to own an Nextel phone. And so this fund invests in those companies. How about the Paws Tombstone Fund? Paws is the name of the mutual fund company. Tombstone is the name of the fund. Oh, no. No, you can't. Yes. It invests in cemeteries and mortuaries. Well, everybody's going to die sometime, and thankfully so did the Paws Tombstone Fund. And this last one, I am not making this up. The Chicken Little Growth Fund. The sky is falling, the sky is falling, so buy the Chicken Little Growth Fund. It's gone. The choices are endless. So are the fees. So there's actually in the sixth edition a little blurb about the funny name, funny different funds. But you can look it up. You can look them up. There's just ridiculous, some of these funds. Just type ridiculous mutual funds into any search engine and you'll see them. Slide number 51, index funds. Well, we've already discussed index funds, right? And they are a big force. They are a big force in the industry. So let's hunker down now and get these things and make sure we understand these, because more likely than not, there will be an index fund choice in your 401k plan. Another name for index funds is passively managed funds. Right, there's no active management. They just look up the names on a list of stocks and that's what they do. These are mutual funds that buy and hold a portfolio of stocks or bonds equivalent to those in a specific market index. And we'll spend quite a bit of time on indexes in Chapter 5, so relax, I apologize. No active management performed, no research. You don't have to have a research organization based all around the world knocking on doors. There's none of it. The mutual fund simply buys all the stocks in the S&P 500, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, or the Dow Jones Wilshire 5000. Why? Because they can offer much lower annual fees, no research, and it turns out many actively managed funds do not beat the index. Yeah, as we saw, the large cap growth fund, the large cap growth fund alliance and the Legg Mason Value Trust did not beat the S&P 500. So why not just buy the index using an index fund? Well, remember, because of the annual fee, an index fund cannot actually match the market's performance, but it should come very close, providing the fee is not that much, whereas an actively managed fund could substantially outperform or underperform the market index. Very important. Slide number 52. The rationale for index funds came from research done in the 1970s that statistically showed that many of the actively managed funds did not beat the market. They often will say, you didn't do as well as a monkey throwing darts at a dartboard. So why shouldn't I just invest in the monkey throwing darts at the dartboard? However, folks, many actively managed funds do beat their respective indices over time. So what you want to do is you want to look for a fund family, and we'll discuss fund families in the next presentation, where most all funds have consistently beaten their indexes over decades. And, by the way, there are only a couple of major companies. In the late 1990s, index funds became a victim of their own success. You see, nothing is perfect, right? Nothing that we humans have ever created is perfect. And in the investing world, once something becomes popular, that's almost a guarantee that it's going to fail. Slide number 53. Here are some very popular indexes. The Standard & Poor 500. Well, we've already seen the Index 500, or the 500 Index, as it's called by Vanguard. The Dow Jones Industrial Average. That's 30 companies, large companies in the United States. The Dow Jones U.S. Total Market Stock in... What's going on? Well, it used to be called the Dow Jones Wilshire 5000, but it used to be called the Wilshire 5000 when Dow Jones bought Wilshire, and so they could basically take the Wilshire 5000, but then they sold Wilshire, and now they call it the Dow Jones U.S. Total Stock Market. Who is Dow, by the way? Dow Jones? Those are the people who published the Wall Street Journal. Yeah. They're now owned by Fox News. Sometimes called the Extended Market Index, there's the NASDAQ. In the NASDAQ 100, we'll discuss what the NASDAQ is in Chapter 5. MSCI World, MSCI Global, MSCI... Wait, what's going on here? Well, the NASDAQ are technology companies, mostly based in the United States. MSCI stands for Morgan Stanley Capital International, but you don't have to remember that. All you have to know is that there is a world index, and it's meant to measure how well the global stock market is doing, and you can invest in an index fund that tracks the global index, the MSCI World. And MSCI has another index called the EAFE Index. And that's how it's pronounced. Europe, Australia, and the Far East. And again, we're getting ahead of ourselves. We'll go into these in detail in the next chapter. That's meant to track the international market. And there are now countless other index funds available. Index funds are the current, they're being supplanted by ETFs. Perfect investment. For the fail-safe superlative treatment, visit IFA.com, stands for Index Fund Advisor. What, if any, are the downsides to index funds? Do you see any downsides? Well, let's take a look at slide 54. And this is not going to, don't worry, we're going to come back to this slide much later on. You'll remember it. Because what happens with indexes? They become skewed sometimes. And what does skewed mean? Skewed. Do you understand what the word skewed means? It means, pushed out of proportion in one place or another, like a bubble or a bulge. They become skewed toward a particular sector of the economy or region of the world. More about this phenomenon later. But let's discuss what's going on here. What is this trying to show you? Well, here's the MSCI EAFE, the Europe, Australia, and the Far East Index. And in the 1980s, some of you weren't around, but some of you were, and you remember that it wasn't China that was going to take over the world. It was Japan. Right. And there was actually a song called I'm Turning Japanese. Hard to believe, but true. The EAFE was skewed toward Japan. Because remember, the EAFE stands for Europe, Australia, and the Far East. And yet, 60%, 59.8% of the EAFE was Japan stocks, Japanese stocks, because the valuations had just gotten so high. And the PE, the higher the number, the riskier in general, the investment, the PE was almost 52. Very high PE. Everybody else, Europe, Australia, and everybody else in the Far East, made up only 40% with a PE of 13. Guess what happened to Japan in the 1990s and then the 2000s? Yeah, Japan lost some 80% of its value, the Japanese stock market, and has been in the doldrums ever since the 1980s. Yeah. So you bought the MSCI EAFE thinking you were going to have a well-diversified international index fund, and it turns out you were buying mostly Japan, which then went on to crash and burn. The same thing happened at the end of the 1990s, the next decade. March of 2000 was the peak, when the Dow hit, I forget, and the NASDAQ hit 5,000 in technology stocks. And the S&P 500, which is the 500 largest companies in based in the United States, was fully one-third information technology, internet and telecom and computer companies and software companies, hardware and chip makers, and with a PE of 59, higher than Japan. Everybody else in the United States, we're talking energy and healthcare and food and utilities and chemicals and housing, everybody else made up two-thirds of the index with a pretty high PE, 19, but much less, one-third of 59, of 60%. What happened over the next 2.5 years? Some of you were very young, but still, the S&P 500 dropped almost 50%, like 49.7 or something like that, between March of 2000 and October of 2002. The NASDAQ, which represents technology, dropped 80%, from 5,000 down to 1,200. So you saw the 500 largest companies in the S&P 500, and after 15 years, since 1985, it had done 15% a year. So it's the new millennial, a new year, new decade, new century, new millennium. You're going to put all your money into the S&P 500, not realizing that one-third of it is going into a sector of the economy, information technology, that is wildly overvalued. So does this make sense? If not, we'll come back to it. But just realize that index funds are not perfect. No investment is. I hope I'm getting that across to you, and by the end of the semester, I hope you do understand that there's no such thing as a perfect investment. All investments have advantages. All have disadvantages. Slide number 55, exchange-traded funds, also called ETFs. And we've already discussed these a little bit. An open-end mutual fund that trades as a listed security on the stock exchange. It looks like a stock, as does a closed-end fund, but unlike the closed-end funds, there is no limit on the number of shares. So in that respect, they're an open-end mutual fund. They've become very popular because they can be bought and sold throughout the day like stocks, unlike open-end mutual funds, which always trade at the end of the day net asset value. So people day trade these things. Not me, and I hope not you. Most all ETFs are passively managed index funds. But now there are some actively managed ETFs that, charge more, of course, because they're doing active management. And the coolest thing about ETFs is their names. The one for the S&P 500 is called SPYDER, because that's the SPY is the symbol for the S&P 500. So it's SPYDER. Isn't that cool? And DIAMOND for the Dow Jones Industrial Average, because that's DIA. And CUBE for the NASDAQ, because the NASDAQ symbol is three Qs or four Qs, a QQQQ, so they call it the CUBE. So wouldn't you like to have an exchange traded fund? And I got spiders. Yeah, whatever. Slide number 56. Socially responsible funds. Come on, Piano, you're pulling my leg. No, I'm not. These are more mutual funds that actively and directly incorporate ethics and morality into the investment decisions. Now, these started out before the name socially responsible became popular. They started out with some funds refusing to invest in companies that sold alcohol or tobacco. And this was mostly a religious conviction for some, and for some a socially responsible. But they've been around, some of these have been around from the 50s or 30s. And then it moved to companies that pollute, build weapons or nuclear power plants, destroy the rainforest, companies that exploit labor. It is surprising that there are any companies left to invest in. Well, silliness aside, many socially responsible funds have actually done quite well for their investors. So, figure that one out. Slide number 57, socially irresponsible funds? Well, that's not what they're called, but possibly as a backlash to socially responsible funds and their perceived political overtones, there is a mutual fund called the Vice Fund. Yep, you guessed it. It invests in tobacco and alcohol. The manager says he simply loves Philip Morris. If you're an investor, who wouldn't? And any and all the other corporate nasties that you can think of, gambling and defense firms. And although it is still a very small fund with high annual fees, it has actually done fairly well for its investors. So if you love tobacco and alcohol, or if you love to make money off of those, but there are many other companies, many other mutual funds that invest in Philip Morris and the like. But check out the Vice Fund. Interesting, huh? That's why I like this industry. I mean, it's really sometimes hard to believe that it's come to this. Slide number 58. What is this? Well, this is actually from the Wall Street Journal. And there are classifications based on Lipper, which is the competitor to Morningstar. We have barely scratched the surface of all the different types of mutual funds that are out there, folks. But we have the most important ones, so make sure you go through the presentation yet again and make sure you know the ones that are in the presentation. If you want to, you know, read more, this is from your book, or you can just read this, or just go, you know, just go online and you'll get a sip from the fire hose if you type in mutual fund types or mutual fund objectives. Slide number 59. Now, one of the companies out there is called Morningstar. They're much more popular than Lipper. Lipper is the older, the stodgier one. Morningstar sought to be the upstart and to be much more slicker and cooler and came up with this wonderful, at least they say it's wonderful, style box. Slide 59. Morningstar, a company that analyzes mutual funds, designed the style box to help investors identify investment alternatives. So in other words, you look at your portfolio and you're going to buy a mutual fund that fits into each every one of these little boxes here. And this is the one for stocks, and they got one for bonds. And so to some extent, Morningstar is kind of responsible, partially. It's not their fault, but they sort of helped the balkanization, the breaking up of mutual funds into very, very small little niches. They say their style boxes are fabulous. But no one that I know uses them, neither do I. They now have evolved into ownership zones. And it's basically this thing with a big oval around it. They say they're even better. Do you notice a hint, a tinge of I could care less? In fact, I don't really like Morningstar. But it's actually, you know, sometimes I use their website. When you go on their website, be careful because they're going to sign you up. They're going to try to sign you up for $30 a month or $10 a month or $50 a month. Premium services. You can go to the library and get it all for, right, yeah. But that's up to you. That's why there's chocolate and vanilla and some people like strawberry. So what have we done? We have really hammered home the major categories of mutual funds, realizing that we're just scratching the surface. Yeah. When we come back, we'll finish up by taking a look at mutual fund families and some of the services of mutual funds, and then how do you choose a mutual fund? It's not easy. See you next time.